About to get weird in here. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And it's not because of our guest that it's about to get weird. Jimmy Akin is our guest. He's senior apologist here. But we've got weird questions for Jimmy. And that's why we call this hour Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Hi, Jimmy.
Howdy. How's it going, Cy Kellett?
It's going very well. Thank you. And I just had an inspiration. I think we have, when we do the game show on Friday, we have special game show music. I think we need some weird questions with Jimmy Akin music. Have I? Is this my first? And I think it's got to be theremin. A little bit of, don't you think?
A little bit. That would be okay. Yeah. Now, for folks who may not know, a theremin is a kind of electronic instrument that is used in some science fiction movies, like Forbidden Planet, and it makes this woo noise, which may be the origin of the phrase woo-woo, which is often used to describe strange, unusual claims.
I think, Sarah, thank you for being here and running the board. Can you research theremin music? But it's got to be in the public domain. We're not paying for theremin music. Although we maybe should pay for it, because I imagine professional theremin players are not making a killing.
Probably not. Not these days. No, it's not the 50s anymore.
Maybe a little employment for a theremin player would be good. I almost gave out the number. I'm not allowed to give out the number. Sarah, just tell me to stop if I start giving out the number, because all of our questions have already been submitted via the internet and its various avenues. Jimmy has very kindly gathered them up for us, and they're all weird. And that's our theme, weird questions for Jimmy Akin. Sometimes, every now and then, we get a call and the person will go, this is a weird question, but I wanted to ask you anyways. And generally speaking, the calls, they're not that weird. They'll be relatively normal, at least by our standards, Jimmy. Maybe the people don't know just exactly how weird we're willing to get.
We're willing to get very weird.
Yeah, and so Jimmy handles a lot of weird stuff on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, his podcast, and we just have a lot of fun with weird questions. So we gather them up and we do this. The podcast, by the way, today I have not watched the episode. I haven't decided if I'm going to listen to the episode. It's on spontaneous human combustion.
That's right, yes. And for people who may not know what that is, occasionally there are reports, they're rare, but there are reports of people who catch on fire for no apparent reason, and almost all of the body is reduced to ashes, but parts of it may strangely survive, especially the feet, and there's virtually no fire damage anywhere else in the room except like maybe the chair they're sitting on.
It's terrifying. It's terrifying to think what this world might contain that we don't know about. All right, you want to do some weird questions, Jimmy?
That's what I'm here for.
Oh, I guess that's true, huh? Gregory said this. How would someone participate in the resurrection at the second coming if they were to have fallen into a black hole or gone near enough to one that time stopped for them relative to everyone else? It has been my impression that the resurrection is supposed to happen for everyone simultaneously. Maybe I am wrong, but how can this be given that time is relative?
So the church obviously doesn't have a teaching here. This is a matter of speculation. It is generally understood that the resurrection will occur for all human beings at the same time. Now, scripture clearly indicates that it's going to apply to all human beings who are here on earth at the time of the second coming. We don't really have a statement of scripture or the magisterium that addresses what would happen to people who are not on earth. But since it seems to apply to the whole human race, the logical assumption would be that it's going to be everybody. So as a way of getting at this question, let's talk about time dilation. Time dilation is something that occurs, according to Einstein's theories of relativity, when you either get in a strong gravitational field or when you start accelerating and moving faster. And so if you're here on Earth, on the surface of the Earth, you're deeper down into Earth's gravity well than you would be if you were up in a plane or, let's say, a hot air balloon just floating above the Earth. And time actually does run slower for those of us who are here on the surface than it does for people who are up in the sky. They've actually measured this with atomic clocks. It's a very tiny amount. It's like, you know, a teeny, teeny little fraction of a second. But it really is true. It's been confirmed. The same thing happens if you're accelerating, if you're moving faster and faster. And they can measure that too. And in fact, if they don't correct for this time dilation, which is where time stretches and gets slower, if they don't correct for this phenomenon with our satellites, the GPS in your phone will stop working within a day or two. It won't be accurate anymore. So they have to constantly correct for this.
Wow.
Yeah. So let's suppose, before we get to the black hole, let's suppose you get on a spaceship and it goes really fast, you're accelerating, you get near the speed of light, so time slows down, and if you hit the speed of light, it would actually stop. Well, the whole rest of the universe is still going on around you. You're just not aging as fast. You're not experiencing as much time, but you're still part of the universe. And so consequently, when the second coming happens, no matter where you are or how fast time is running for you at the moment, God can grab you out of that spaceship and judge you. So that's not a problem in and of itself. So now let's apply that to what happens with time in a strong gravitational field like a black hole has. Now, the thing about black holes is they have so much mass that the gravity they generate is able to stop light from leaving them. Because remember, time slows down. And so if time is slowing down, then the light's not traveling as fast. And eventually, if time stops, the light can't go anywhere. So it can't come out of the black hole. And if you go into a black hole, well, okay, realistically, what would happen under ordinary circumstances is you would just die. Because as you go into a black hole, your body is, all the matter in your body is stretched out, and it's a phenomenon called spaghettification, because you get made like spaghetti, you know, and eventually you're just a stream of atoms with no physical form. And so at that point, you would die and your soul would go to heaven. But suppose that didn't happen. Suppose you somehow survived, and so you're in the black hole, and you still have your body, and time is stopped. Well, the reason that black holes are black is because the light can't escape, and that's because of the mass that the black hole has, and that's related to the strength of gravity, to the gravitational constant of the universe. Also, the speed of light is thought to be governed by two properties that space has. One of them is known as vacuum permittivity, and the other is vacuum permeability. And so we've got like three physical constants that are governing the fact you can't get out of the black hole. But the physical constants of the universe are under God's control, and they could be different than they are. And so God can simply change the constants if he needs to and pluck you out of the black hole and judge you. So I would say, on the very reasonable assumption that this is going to happen to everybody at the same time, if you're in a black hole or in a spaceship that's severely time dilated, God will grab you wherever you are.
I am very grateful. Thanks very much for the question. I appreciate that. But I was thinking, you know, spaghettification is bad enough, but spaghettification and then you can't participate in the resurrection, that would be awful. So,
yeah.
I'm Gregory. I'm glad that one worked out. Thanks for the weird question. We're going to take a break. I want to let you know that the newest School of Apologetics course, Evidence for the Church, from Tim Staples, is available. And it's 50% off for the entire month of April. 50% off. You just go to schoolofapologetics.com and get Evidence for the Church, the newest course from Tim Staples, schoolofapologetics.com.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at catholic.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Unplanned, the true story of Abby Johnson.
I would be the youngest director in Planned Parenthood history.
She believed in a woman's right to choose.
I've had an abortion myself, so I don't have any problem with another woman making the same decision.
Until the day she saw something that changed everything.
Tiny, perfect little baby. And then it was just gone.
Now she's pulling back the curtain on the abortion industry. Unplanned.
Available at EWTNRC.com and the EWTN app.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Weird questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. The questions have come to us via the internet and its various tools, and they're all weird, and Jimmy is here to answer them. So I won't be giving out the phone number. Just relax and enjoy the weird questions and the possibly weird answers. I do not know if this says something bad about me, Jimmy, but spaghettification makes me hungry. Mm-hmm. When you mention spaghettification, I all of a sudden I'm hungry.
It has that effect on a lot of people.
I'm going to go home.
Until you think seriously about what it involves and does to the human body. Then you might be less hungry.
Yeah, right. Exactly. All right. Martin has a very succinct but fascinating question. Martin, thank you for the question. What would happen if Adam and Eve had children before they fell?
Of course, it's a matter of speculation, but since human nature had not been damaged before the fall, it would have been able to perform its role, its original function that God intended us to be able to do of passing on sanctifying grace to offspring. And so the children would have inherited sanctifying grace. It would have functioned basically the marital act would have functioned as a kind of sacrament in communicating grace to the offspring. And so they would have been born unfallen and in a state of original innocence or original blessing. Now, what would have happened then is more speculative. Adam and Eve were given what theologians refer to as a period of probation, where they could disobey God, but they also had the option of obeying him. And the thought is that if they had chosen to obey him, if they had chosen not to fall into sin, then at some point they would have been confirmed in grace. And so it could be that the children, if they had been born without original sin, they might have been in the same state Adam and Eve were. They might have been in a probationary period where they had freedom to resist sin, but also freedom to sin. And if they passed the probationary period, then they might have been confirmed in grace also. However, it's also possible that, especially if Adam and Eve had been confirmed in grace, that their kids would have been born confirmed in grace as well. If they, though, had this period of probation, then we would be in a kind of interesting situation because we know Adam and Eve eventually fell. So what would happen with these kids? Well, it could be that the kids might have had the ability to resist the fall. And so you could have a situation where you've got fallen parents and unfallen children, which would be very interesting. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's another theory that Adam specifically, or you could stretch it to Adam and Eve, are what are sometimes called the federal head of the human race. And the idea there is that as Adam or Adam and Eve go, so goes everybody else. And so it could be that if Adam fell or if Adam and Eve fell, that effect would have rippled to their children, who then would have fallen as well, even if and lost the original innocence, even if they hadn't personally sinned. But all of this is speculation, so we don't really know.
Martin, thank you very, very much. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, and our guest, you'll be surprised to find out, is Jimmy Akin. Next weird question comes from Kyle. In the season finale of a popular TV show, a philosophical paradox known as the Ship of Theseus was alluded to. Having never heard of this, I did a web search. From what I can gather, it goes something like this. If you take the Ship of Theseus and you begin replacing its parts piece by piece, wooden board by wooden board, by the time you've replaced the entire ship, is it still the same ship? Is there a particularly Catholic and well-informed way to approach this question with our understanding of form, nature, and the soul? I understand that our physical bodies undergo a similar ongoing process, shedding and recycling out old dead cells and replacing them with new and better cells, yet I am still me. I don't know that all the cells that replace them are better. At my age, I think some of the new cells that have come in and are not as good as the old ones. But other than that, I'm down with the question.
Okay. So one aspect, and he accurately summarizes what the ship of Theseus is. It's a paradox that goes all the way back to the Greek philosophers, which is why it's got the name Theseus in it. And the idea is you've got this ship, and you start replacing it plank by plank, and eventually you've substituted new planks for all of the old ones. Is it the same ship? And one of the things that kind of adds an exclamation point or a zinger to this paradox is after you've replaced all the planks, if you've still got the original planks, you could reconstruct the original ship, and you'd have two ships. Which one is the ship of Theseus?
Oh, yeah.
And so... philosophers have thought about this, and including Christian philosophers, and they've applied it to humans because our bodies do replace the cells that are in them over time. Here's how I would look at it. In the case of an artificial object like a ship, when you replace all of the parts in it, it can be considered the same ship. Let's say I'm Theseus, I'm the owner. And you replace a plank in it. Okay, you replaced one plank now. That's still my ship. Legally, that is my ship. And you keep replacing planks, and legally, it's always still my ship.
Yeah.
So in terms of categories of human convenience, like legality, you can say, yeah, this is my ship. This is still the same ship, effectively. If someone goes to the dumpster and gets out all the original planks and reconstructs a ship out of them, well, that's not my ship legally. That's somebody else's ship. And it's, you know, finders, keepers, losers, weepers. So whoever found the original planks and put them together again, that's their ship now. So I think there are ways of handling artificial objects like this. It becomes more interesting when we're talking about natural things like life forms, including human beings. And life forms have a soul, which is what enables them to be alive. And the soul does not get replaced when the individual parts are replaced. So I always have the same soul, even if every cell in my body changes out over time. And so the soul is what a Christian philosopher would typically look to as the fundamental principle of continuity in an individual. Now, a question obviously comes up, well, what about with the resurrection of the dead? And, you know, because when our bodies get put back together, because if we have had all kinds of matter processed through our bodies with all these different cells we've had in us over the course of our lifetimes, what happens when we come back from the dead? And the answer is we don't know. One of the things that's part of the discussion on this was a document that came out from the International Theological Commission a number of years ago on certain questions regarding the last things. And they pointed out that, you know, the resurrection of the dead is an event that involves our physical bodies, but the church has never said it requires exactly the same matter to have our resurrected body. It doesn't necessarily require all of the same matter or even some of the same matter that was in there originally. It's hypothetically possible that just your soul attached to this matter makes it your body, regardless of what happened with the original matter. On the other hand, since we know that Jesus's body was not in the grave when he returned from the dead, and our resurrection is going to be like his, it would seem that at least in his case, and presumably in our case, a lot of that matter, at least that was in the grave, did end up in Jesus's resurrected body, and presumably the same thing would happen to us.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah, because we can see there's such a short time period there that his body doesn't fall apart or doesn't decompose.
Doesn't decay. Yeah. Now, if someone's body did totally decay, God could still find whatever matter he needed that had been part of that person to make a resurrected body for them, or it could be that the soul is simply enough.
All right, next question. What's weird questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. Next question comes from Bob. Mr. Akin, I have been pondering a question that I suspect only you are equipped to answer in a way I can understand. Recently, on an episode, you explained Olber's paradox. Since I first read about this idea several years ago in one of Stephen Hawking's books, I cannot help but think that it is in error. Mr. Akin, please tell me where I've gone wrong. It would seem to me that if the universe was of an infinite size and had no beginning, and the concentration of light sources throughout the universe is the same as we observe in our visible universe, then the night sky would look the same or very similar to what we see now. This would be due to the fact that as more and more stars exist further and further away from us, the light from those distant stars is increasingly dim. Ultimately, the light reaching us from those stars becomes infinitesimally small and imperceivable to the human eye. The rate of light reaching us on a nightly basis would be only marginally changed from what we see now, as distant stars could have rates of light sent to the Earth at one photon a year or a decade or a century. I have trouble believing that I'm right about this and that you, Stephen Hawking, and Heinrich Olbers are wrong about this. I also don't believe we live in an infinite physical universe with no beginning. I just don't see how Olbers' paradox lends any support to that belief.
Okay, so Olber's paradox is something that has been speculated about for several centuries, and it was one of the people who made it famous is a German astronomer named Heinrich Olbers. And the basic idea is, suppose the universe is infinitely big and that we're surrounded by stars on all sides. So if you went far enough out in space, you would eventually, in any direction, you would eventually hit a star, because there would be an infinite number of stars around us in an evenly distributed pattern. So if you go far enough out, you'd eventually hit a star. Now, if the universe is infinitely big and it has stars evenly distributed through it that way, and if it's infinitely old, then there will have been time for the light of those stars to reach Earth. And so every single patch in the sky, since there's a star out there somewhere, some finite distance away, there will be light reaching us from that star after an infinite amount of time. And therefore, the night sky should be as bright as the face of the sun. And it's obviously not. So that's the question behind Olber's paradox. Why is the night sky dark? Now, it seems to me that the problem that Bob is having is he's thinking of light as intermittent. He talks about if a star is far enough away, we'll only be getting one photon per year, decade, or century. And actually, that wouldn't be the case. Once a star flips on, you know, once it ignites, it gets enough mass that it starts burning its nuclear fuel, it emits photons continuously, just like our sun does. It's continuously emitting photons. And since we're close to the sun, we get a lot of photons or light particles from the sun. So if a star is very distant, it's true, we won't be receiving as many photons from it. And if it's very, very far away, then could be receiving only like a single particle of light, a single photon from that star. It's so far away that all the other photons it emits go elsewhere. But we get this one, because if you go far enough out in space, there's going to be a star there. And we should, after infinite amount of time, be getting at least one photon from it. So if you imagine the entire sky being filled with these stars, even if we're only getting one photon from them continuously, the whole sky should still light up. And that's a clue that either the universe is not infinitely big or it's not infinitely old. Now, we know that the physical universe is at least 200 times as big as the visible universe. We've been able to do measurements of the shape of the universe that show us the physical universe is at least 200 times bigger than what we can see. We don't know if it's infinite or not in size, but we do have evidence that it's not infinite in time because of the Big Bang. And the Big Bang, which occurred about 13.8 billion years ago, is the reason the sky is dark. Because after the Big Bang, everything blew up and there has not been time for light to reach us from these very distant locations. And so the fact the sky is dark is actually evidence that the universe had a beginning.
I love it. And 13.8 billion years or whatever it is, that's a lot of time, but that's not even close to infinite.
Nope.
It's, as a matter of fact, infinitely far from infinite.
That's right.
Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. More weirdness coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Most of us Catholic parents agree our number one goal in life is to pass on the faith to our children. But here's the bad news. Today's world has a million ways to steal your kid's soul. Don't be afraid, says Father Sebastian Walsh. God loves your children even more than you do, and he desires their salvation more than anything. In his groundbreaking new book, Always a Catholic, Father Walsh shows you how to cooperate with God to bring about the fulfillment of his will for your kids. Always a Catholic reminds us that keeping our kids in the faith is about the way we live our Catholicism in our own lives and as a family from day to day. Order your copy of Always a Catholic by visiting shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. It's free, and you'll have instant access to our daily broadcast, the schedule of upcoming shows, and you'll even be able to search the archive and listen to thousands of past shows. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Jesus told us to carry our cross daily.
Does yours sometimes seem too heavy?
That's our topic on Monday on Take Two with Jerry and Debbie on most of these EWTN stations.
Now more of Catholic Answers Live.
Not only is it weird questions with Jimmy Akin, it's unexpected groovy music with Jimmy Akin, and Sarah is looking shocked that groovy music is playing. Did you not know that that was going to play? Oh, well, I'll say thank you anyway. We always enjoy the groovy music. Thanks, Sarah.
Yeah.
Jimmy Akin's our guest, which always is good when you're doing weird questions with Jimmy Akin. It's not the same to do weird questions with Jimmy Akin when you're not here.
Have you been doing weird questions with other people?
I just sit here and read the questions and nothing happens.
Okay.
They're terribly boring shows. So next one comes from John. Not being an expert on Thomas Aquinas, this one caught me off guard. I was asked if Thomas views God as being outside of time, and therefore, if there is time in heaven. I wasn't quite sure where to find the answer, but the question is basically, if the conclusion of Thomas' belief about motion meant that heaven would be an eternal moment, so I guess everyone would be sitting around in front of God, frozen like statues. Is this anywhere close to what we can reason or what can reasonably be understood from his writings? Also, if there's no time or movement in heaven, how can the saints hear our prayers or intercede for us? Is this just a big misunderstanding?
So this one comes up a lot, and it's understandable why it comes up. It's frankly because people get sloppy in how they talk about this, and it leads to confusion. So John is right that Aquinas does believe that God is outside of time. It's also common to talk about us going to heaven and being with God. And people kind of infer from that, well, okay, if God's outside of time and we go to be with God, then we're going to be outside of time and we're going to be frozen like statues. And that doesn't seem to correspond to the idea of us being able to worship God in heaven or us being able to intercede for people on earth or things like that. The problem is caused by the going to be with God image. That is not physical. God does not have a physical location. That is not a unique physical location. He is omnipresent. He is everywhere in space and time by his power, because by his power, he is creating everywhere in space and time. If there's a place or a time, it wouldn't exist if God wasn't creating it right now. And so God, as a result, we talk about God being everywhere, including heaven. Now, heaven does not really mean up in the sky. That's a metaphor that God uses to help us understand that it's a different place than here. And because humans associate up with goodness, you know, things are more important if they're bigger or taller or higher.
Okay.
If they're exalted, in other words, it becomes this heaven or the sky becomes an image that's metaphorically suitable to describe God and where he is, which has to be the best. But it's not the case that he literally occupies a place up in the sky or anywhere else in this universe that's uniquely his place, the way where you're sitting, Cy, behind a microphone is uniquely your place. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about being with God in heaven, that's a spiritual form of union. Now, obviously, our resurrection bodies are going to be somewhere, but where Scripture depicts that as happening is here on earth, on the restored, renovated new earth. So we will continue to have a physical location, and we will be in spiritual heavenly union with God, but we do not go outside of time. And that's clear. Because the same thing is true of angels. The church teaches that if you're a creature, you have some kind of existence in space and time. So there are no creatures that don't at least occupy time. And that's not to say that time doesn't work differently in the afterlife than it works here. John was asking about St. Thomas Aquinas in particular, he viewed the afterlife, at least prior to the resurrection, and also the way angels experience time as somewhat different than we do. He recognized God as being in eternity, which means outside of time, and us as being fully in time in this life. And he proposed a middle state for angels and departed human souls. And this middle state he called aveternity, and it shares some properties of time and some properties of eternity. So it's not strictly exactly like one or the other. It's different than both. And that's a fine theological speculation. It's only a speculation. It could be that time works exactly the same way in the afterlife or for angels that it works for us. But it's clear that there is something time-like about what angels and departed human souls experience, because in both cases, we see them experiencing things in a sequence. So when, in the case of a human, you die, you experience the particular judgment. If you need to go to purgatory, you go to purgatory. It, once you get purified from in purgatory, you go to heaven, and then you're in heaven, and then the resurrection comes, and you get your body back, and you experience the general judgment, and you then live in the eternal order on the new earth. And in all of that, you do other things. You know, while you're in heaven or even purgatory, you may be praying for people on earth. In the eternal order, it's said that we're going to reign with Christ, and reigning means doing stuff. So it's clear that there's a sequentiality to the future of human experience. We see the same thing with angels. You know, angels were created at some point. They had a decision to make for or against God. In the case of good angels, they periodically come down and do stuff. So they experience sequentiality. In the case of demons, it's even more interesting because most of them, or at least many of them, are still running around loose. Some of them have been, according to scripture, chained in pits of darkness and are reserved for the final judgment. So some of them have this creation, fall, get chained up, later experience the final judgment. Others are running around, but then one day they're also going to experience judgment. And so we see a sequentiality both for humans and for angelic beings, and thus both of us have to experience at least something like time, and maybe time exactly as we experience it.
Wow. John, thank you for the question. It does leave me with this, Jimmy, if I may. Mm-hmm. Does that mean all of that, what you just said, that Jesus, in becoming incarnate, he too never in his human nature never goes completely outside of time? He too exists in time with us.
He exists in some form of time and something at least like space, because he took his body with him into heaven.
Right.
So heaven as it presently is, which is different than what it'll be on the new earth, but heaven as it presently is at least capable of receiving a physical body. Whether that physical body is extended in space exactly the way our bodies are, we can't know, but it's at least capable of receiving a physical body.
John, I'm really happy that you gave us that question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. There are more weird questions coming up. We're going to take a quick break. Don't forget, it's spring. We've got the spring sale going on, 15 to 25% off everything at shop.catholic.com. As a matter of fact, in some cases, a few cases, more than 25% off. Visit shop.catholic.com and get your spring savings.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
People often wonder about the power of prayer. Why do we pray anyway if we end up having to do so much work for ourselves? Well, the reality is, we find ourselves up against a wall, and we pray, it's like God turns a light up on the other side of that wall. Brighter and brighter and brighter, until the light shines through the tiniest cracks. God might not do it all for me, but He shows me how to make my work more efficient, so that together we can accomplish all things through His grace.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. So happy to be with you on this Friday afternoon or evening or early morning, Saturday, depending on where you are listening live around the world. Jimmy Akin is our guest. He's the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. He's the author of a whole bunch of books, including The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness, and Where to Find It. And he's senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And in addition to all of that, he likes weird questions. So we love to do weird questions with Jimmy Akin.
I like them because they give you a workout. You know, so many questions. I mean, I've been doing this now since at Catholic Answers for 28 years this June. And after a certain point, a lot of the questions, it's like, okay, hit the hotkey. Here comes the macro. Here's the answer. They're a little bit old hat, but these make you think, and I like that.
Do you ever, you just kind of feel almost like my mouth is giving the answer, my brain is, I can do what I like. All right, the next one, maybe you'll help me. I think Wojcik would be how I would pronounce this name. How would
Wojcik? Yeah, uh-huh.
Wojcik, okay.
Wojcik.
I have discovered that someone, no, I'm sorry, Wojcik. If I discovered that someone has an object that can be spiritually dangerous to someone, would it be a sin to secretly take it and dispose of it without that someone's consent? If it can be done without his notice, and if it can be presumed that he wouldn't give up that object if informed about its danger. I'm talking primarily about objects that don't have much morally acceptable uses. For example, let's say my friend got a bunch of old books and magazines and asked for help sorting them. In doing that, I found pornographic material. And because I know my friend, I know it may be dangerous for him. Would it be a sin or theft if I took the dangerous material, destroyed it without informing the owner? What can be morally done in this kind of situation?
So the sin of theft is taking property against the reasonable will of its legal owner. And if it's true that this is – that whatever you find, whether it's pornography or something else, if it's not reasonable for this person to retain it, you could take it without his consent and knowledge in this case. It would not be the sin of theft. Now, in making that assessment, you have a number of factors to consider. One of them is whether or not it really poses a spiritual danger to this person that is real and that doesn't have a compensating reason for. So, for example, back during the 1980s, President Reagan established like a panel on to study pornography and make recommendations about how to fight it. And among the people that were appointed to that panel was James Dobson, the founder of Focus on the Family. And so Dobson had to view some things that were possibly pornographic in order to make evaluations and recommendations. So in that case, even though there was a danger to him looking at these things and being able to say, okay, him and other people on the panel, is this pornography or not? Where should we draw the line and how can this be regulated? You know, because you have to know what you're regulating if you're going to regulate it. Somebody has to look at that stuff to make a determination and craft the policies. And so there was a compensating reason, even though there was some risk. Our job in life as Christians is not to avoid all risk. If you try to avoid all risk and all temptation, you're not going to actually be living the Christian life because you're going to be living under a rock and it's not going to be healthy for you and you're not going to be doing good for other people, which is what Dobson and the other panelists were trying to do. Okay? They were trying to find ways to craft policies that would protect other people from pornography, and that meant they had to have some degree of exposure themselves. So we're assuming that's not the case. And in a typical situation, if you know someone who's had a pornography problem and they get a lot of books from somewhere, okay, well, you can presume that there's not some counterbalancing good if it's pure pornography. You know, you look at a magazine and it's like, oh, wow, okay, let's get this out of here. But you have to be careful with this because it may not – if it's not obvious pornography, then it may not pose the same risk. For example, I can imagine some people in this situation being kind of scrupulous and they don't find a pornographic magazine, but they may find a romance novel and they don't know what's in the romance novel. Is this one of the pornographic ones or is this Jane Eyre? You know,
yeah.
And I can see people being kind of scrupulous about that, or, you know, it could be Romeo and Juliet or whatever it may be. not every story involving romance is going to pose a moral challenge to everybody. And so you have to be careful in evaluating things like this. You can't just say, oh, it's in this area, so I'm going to steal it to protect this guy. Also, there are other things that have perfectly legitimate uses. Like, let's say the guy is asking you to help go through an attic of stuff from his grandfather that he's inherited. And in the attic, you find a gun. Well, guns have perfectly legitimate uses, whether it's target practice or self-defense or whatever it may, or hunting. Just because you found a gun doesn't mean, oh, I better take this away from this guy. Now, if he's mentally unstable and can't responsibly own a gun, that's one thing. But you have to be careful in evaluating these things. Also, you have to evaluate the consequences of taking the item. Because if he finds out you took it, what is that going to do to your friendship? That's a factor that has to be weighed. Also, what is it going to do to his view of Christians? If he looks at you and says, you're this crazy moralizing Christian that's trying to run my life, that could push him away from God rather than setting a better example that's more loving and open. If you come across as this strict moralizer who has no tolerance for other people's views, you can actually push someone away from Christ. This is something St. Paul talks about in his letter to the Romans, where he tells some of his Jewish readers that God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of what you're doing.
Yeah.
And in the same way, we Christians have to look out for that, we Gentile Christians included. Also, there are simple practical preservation reasons. Like, let's suppose you find a weapon in the attic and your friend is mentally unbalanced. Well, okay, if you can get that weapon away safely without him knowing, fine. But you also need to take into account he's mentally unbalanced. If he finds out, he might try to kill me. And I might have a family that depends on me. So maybe I should call in the authorities or something instead of doing it myself. So there are a bunch of things to think about here. But in principle, it is possible to not commit the sin of theft as long as you're taking something without, as long as it's not contrary to the reasonable will of the owner. So if it's not reasonable for him to have this, you could take it for his protection or the protection of others.
All right. Thanks very much for the question, Wojciech. I appreciate that. I hope that was helpful to you. We're going to go to Lisa in Houston, Texas. Her weird question for Jimmy Akin: would or could Lazarus have had a near-death experience?
Well, since he died and came back from it, he had a full death experience.
That's as near as you can get.
could say he had a near-death experience. But the term is ambiguous. There actually are a variety of phenomena that are reported as occurring near death. These can include things like crisis apparitions. A crisis apparition is where someone is either dying or about to die or otherwise in danger. They're in some kind of crisis, and they appear to people, you know, who are distant. Maybe a loved one suddenly sees Dad as he's in the, you know, as he's dying, or has a dream about Dad as he's dying. I know a friend that happened to. Also, the people who are in danger of death or are about to die often will have visionary experiences. They may sense the presence of angels or loved ones in the room. They may see a glimpse of what the next world is like. This happened to an uncle of mine who actually didn't die, but he was close to death, and he was talking about all the amazing, beautiful things he was seeing. So, you know, these are reported phenomena that occur to a large number of people. Now, the classic near-death experience that I suspect that Lisa is talking about here. Oh, and by the way, my uncle lives in Houston even. But the classic near-death experience that I suspect Lisa in Houston is talking about is the kind that was popularized or discussed in a popular way by Raymond Moody in his book Life After Life back in the 1970s, and that has been kind of standard in the literature ever since. Basically, people clinically die And then when they come back, they report various things, which can include floating above their body and seeing what people are doing to them as they're trying to bring them back. It can include going through a dark tunnel. It can include meeting friends and loved ones. It can be having a review of everything you've done in your life. It could be encountering an angel or Jesus. It could be seeing a beautiful environment where there are happy people and so forth. These are all commonly reported elements. Not everyone sees the same things or reports the same things when they come back, perhaps because this is a non-physical experience and it's hard to cram all that into a physical brain once their heart gets started again. So they may lose certain aspects of the experience. But it's quite possible that Lazarus may have had all of those kind of things happen to him. Whether he would have remembered them when he got back into his body or how much he would have remembered them is a question we really don't have the answer to. By the way, in Star Trek: The Search for Whales, after they've got Spock back in his body,
it's not the name of it. It's not Star Trek: The Search for Whales.
It's how I think of it. It's
okay, yeah.
Voyage Home. But yeah. After they've gotten Spock's soul back in his body at the end of Star Trek III, in Star Trek IV, McCoy asks him, "So you've really been where no man has gone before? I mean, you died. What can you tell me about it?" And Spock just says, "It would be impossible to discuss the phenomenon without a common frame of reference."
But as far as Lazarus goes, though, he did die.
He did die. He was dead for 4 days, and then he got brought back.
All right. Next weird question for Jimmy Akin. Jot Baleos asks, "Hi, Mr. Akin. I am a fan of your podcast and books because it keeps my faith burning and not burning out. My question is, if Jesus had children, would his children be demigods or just normal humans?"
So if Jesus had children, there are two things that we need to think about here. The first one is Jesus's divine nature, which is the reason he's God. And the second is his human nature. Now, in the case of like Greek demigods, like Heracles, or no, as he's known by the Romans, Hercules, he's a half-breed. He's the son of Zeus and a mortal woman. And this shows us that the Greek gods are, scientifically speaking, the same species as humans because they're capable of breeding with us. And so if the Greeks had known about DNA, presumably God DNA, like Zeus has, would be different than regular human DNA, but it's compatible with human DNA. Now, they didn't know about that, but what they did say in their mythology was that, you know, people like Heracles or Hercules have some qualities that are like ordinary humans, so they're not full gods, but they have other qualities that are like the gods of Olympus. And so they have qualities that are a mixture of the two. And today we would explain that in terms of DNA, which is part of our physical nature. So Jesus has a divine nature, and his divine nature is indivisible and it's immutable. And therefore it could not be inherited by any children that he might have had. So they would not be divine for that reason. What they would inherit is DNA from his human nature, but we don't have any reason to think that his DNA was dramatically different than our DNA, than regular human DNA, because he didn't have a superhuman nature. He had a human nature. And so consequently, the children presumably would be humans and fairly normal humans. They might be unfallen, though, because Jesus has an unfallen nature, and thus he could pass on original innocence to purely human offspring. But this is all speculative, and it's something that we probably shouldn't speculate too much about. But no, his children would not be demigods if he had chosen to have children.
Jot Baleos, thank you so much for the question. Appreciate that. Jimmy Akin, our guest, answered a lot of weird questions. If you like Jimmy's weird questions, check out Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. You've got, 100 and how many episodes now?
As of next week, it'll be 150. We're doing our 150th episode. It's a mysterious update on updates for all different kinds of mysteries we've covered over the last 2 years.
And this week, it's people just
spontaneous
blowing
human
up.
Combustion.
Yep.
Yeah.
Spontaneous human combustion. Do you know what's next week yet? Because I might just look forward to that one. And
well, it's the mysterious updates, 150th anniversary.
Oh, that's next week. Gotcha.
And the week after that is the Cold War Operation Northwoods secret plan.
All right. Thanks, Jimmy. Thanks very much. I got to work with you a lot this week, and I've always liked that.
Always a pleasure.
All right. That'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here at Catholic Answers Live.